Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good morning. Isn't it wonderful? Wonderful. I wanted to just say that Lynn and Cody were just marvelous last night. Let's give them another hand. Also, I want to thank Betty and Charles for giving me the privilege of doing this. It doesn't feel like a privilege, but it's supposed to be, so that's what I'll feel. I feel very privileged. My name is Jo Ellen, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February the 5th, 1983. And for that, I'm very grateful. I'm going to do the steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, and I had prepared mightily for this. I had written notes and underlined pieces in my big book that I was going to come up here and read to y'all. And I got up here the other day, and I started looking for my big book, and I couldn't find it. And so I said, I've got to have a big book. Does somebody have a big box? So Nancy, that's in my dorm with me, said, well, you can use mine. And so I went over there and opened it up. And I had like page 67. That's all I'd put, page 67. Well, I forgot what I circled on page 67, you know. So I didn't have a chance to, couldn't remember which one it was. So I finally just said, you know, I think God doesn't want me to have this big book with me today. I'm just supposed to get up there and talk from the heart. And hopefully that's what I'll do today. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about my drinking because it's just to qualify. I was always a very fearful child. And I'm the oldest daughter. My parents, neither one drank, but we had a crazy, chaotic life. My dad was kind of a rageaholic, and we always had to tiptoe around when he was home. And my mom, a very loving mother, and but didn't really know how to love since she was an orphan and raised by her grandparents. So she was a little impaired and to be able to teach me how to love. So when I was very young, she told me that it took her 3 days to have me. She was in labor for 3 days. And after I got in AA and I found out about all these fears that I had, I'm afraid of everything, you know. And I blamed my grandmother for those fears, and I'll tell you what some of them are. But when I heard how about, you know, found out through doing the inventories, which I do all the time. I found out that I probably was up there in that womb saying, I'm not going down that dark tunnel there. It's too scary. Mine is genetic. My fear just was there, you know. It was always there. Like I said, I tried to blame it on my grandmother because they lived on a farm and she said, don't go near the chickens. They'll peck your eyes out. And, cows would just run you over, you know, or gore you if they happen to have horns. Also, I had to look in the toilet every time to make sure there was no snake in it. She lived back in the olden days, you know, and the toilet that she was going to, there probably was a snake in there. But I took this all to heart. And it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I realized, I've got seven first cousins, and my brother and sister, which is, makes another two. That's nine grandchildren. Okay? And the only scaredy one was me. I got called scaredy cat my whole life. If I wouldn't, because I wouldn't walk across the fallen log on the creek, you know, oh, you're a scaredy cat, scaredy cat, scaredy cat. Fear has been a part of my life, and unfortunately, it still is. It's not gone totally away. There are still things that I'm fearful of. But I know now what to do for that fear. And so I pray to God every day to remove my fear, because I wake up every morning fearful. I met my husband, my future husband, when I was 14 years old, and he was 14 years old. And we went together, and then we got married rather young at 16. And I had two young daughters by the time I was 19. So we grew up pretty fast. Now, when Mike and I were going together, he drank quite heavily. Excuse me. But I was convinced that after we were married, that would all change. And it did. Oh, my. He just had more freedom to run around all the time and drink. And he didn't have his mother on him. But he tried to get me to drink with him when we were dating. And he would give me a beer. I'd take one sip and go back behind the car and vomited up. I said, oh, my God, this is horrible stuff I've ever had. Why in the world would you drink this? And I never, ever got enough down me to get the effect. It's what I finally realized after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never did get that. I'd vomit it all up. So after we were married, we went to parties quite often, and of course there was much drinking and carousing and dancing around with table lamps, you know, shades on your head, and police being called from somebody down the street about the rowdy party going on, and running out the back door. We had one night, this guy, they said, the cops are coming, the cops are coming. So he ran out the back door and ran into the clothesline and caught him right here and just flipped him about three times. But he jumped up and kept on running. Well, one night I'm sitting up in the front of the house and everybody else is drinking and having fun, and I'm just really ticked off at the whole situation, you know. Here I am, married, and my husband is just off, you know, getting drunk all the time. What is this? I don't understand it. I couldn't understand what the fascination was, you know. So one night we were with this guy, like I said, we were at a party, and his name, Clinker was his nickname, and he came up to me and he said, let me fix you a drink. I said, I don't drink. He said, oh, well, everybody's got to drink, you know. You somebody that doesn't drink? He said, oh, I'll fix you something that you'll like. And I said, well, okay, I'll try it. But no beer. I don't want any beer. Ooh, that stuff's awful. So he came back with a bourbon and Coke. And I gave it to me. And I looked at it and I thought, well, I, guess I could take a little sip of it. Maybe it's not too bad. So I took a sip, and I thought, well, that gives me a little warm feeling in my tummy. So I took another bigger sip, and I said, oh, goodness, that's even better. No wonder these people drink this stuff. This is wonderful stuff. You know, all my fear went away. I was dancing with lampshades on my head next. And running out the door at the back of the house when the police were called. And I jumped in with both feet. But I had kind of a restraint of a little bit, excuse me, on myself because I had two young daughters, you know. And when you got kids, you just can't, you know, drop everything and run to the nearest bar with your husband every night. So I got a big resentment about that. You know, that was one of the worst resentments that I had. And when I finally got here and Edwin was doing my fourth step, you know, that I was, not allowed to party with other people. So this rocked on for quite some time. And after the children got bigger and were able to stay by themselves more, and so I started drinking more and more with mine. But I drank because he drank, you know. If you had my husband, you would drink too. That was my motto. And I blamed him. And I blamed my family of origin for all the fear and all the ways I felt bad. It was all their fault, you know. And I was just full of, I was a victim from the word go, you know. And after getting, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out that the victim mentality is pretty well embedded in my family, my whole family. You know, you gotta have a victim in your family somewhere, and I was the one. And I blamed everybody and everything except myself. I wasn't responsible for anything. But after I got to AA and I realized that I was a victim, it was quite some time, but I realized that in the big book it talks about that if we look far enough back in our life, we can find when we made a decision based on self that started the ball rolling. I remember one night when I was about 5 or 6 years old, maybe 7, I was in the bed, and I said a prayer. I said, God, I'm not going to ever love anybody else again. I'm not going to trust anybody ever else again, because it hurts too much. Now, when I was a little girl, this helped me to get through what I had to get through, because I closed down emotionally. And that's where I finally realized that I was going to have to, when I got there, I was going to have to learn to trust again. I was going to have to learn how to love again. I was going to have to take down all the brick walls and all the walls that I'd built up around myself to prevent me from being hurt. Now, when I got to, excuse me, I just recently have been diagnosed with a lung disorder, and so I get kind of stopped up every once in a while, so I've got to drink some more water. Well, hi, Billy. Okay. So I'm went to Al-Anon the first time around. Mike went to AA because I just thought I was an Al-Anon, you know. Of course, I didn't stop drinking. And so I just kept drinking, and then Mike decided he wasn't an alcoholic, so he quit AA. And I kept going to Al-Anon. I went to Al-Anon about another year, and one night I was getting drunk with Mike while I was going to Al-Anon. And we were sitting in our den, and Mike had had quite a bit to drink, and he said, "Are you still going to Al-Anon?" I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Well, I don't want you to go anymore. Every time you go, you say you're telling everybody that I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "I'm going to divorce you if you don't quit." And I know you've heard Billy that she did the same thing. She was smart though, because she just went ahead and kept going. But it scared me, being the scary person I am. I think, "Oh God, you know, he's going to leave me. He's made me crazy, now he's going to leave me." So I got in the car, and I drove over to my Al-Anon sponsor's house, and it was late, and it was raining, and it was cold, and I had on shorts. Don't ask me that, but you know how you are when you're drinking. And so I knocked on the door, and she came to the door and pulled the door open just a little bit and looked out there and said, "Joellen, what are you doing over here?" And looked at her watch. So I have no idea what time it was. May have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, "I've just come to tell you that I am resigning from Al-Anon." And she said, "Well, you sweet thing. I'll pray for you and we'll see you again someday." Little did we know that it would be across the hall. So, you know, I made a decision then that Mike and I were just going to go down in flames together. We'd been together for all these years, and we'd just both just drink ourselves to death. No, there wasn't anything else to do. So one night he comes home and he says, "I'm going to an AA meeting." I said, "Well, I'm not going to quit drinking." Now, this is a person that's been trying for years to get her husband to quit drinking so that I can quit. You know, if he quits, then I can quit. So he went with another person. He said, "Oh, it's not for me. It doesn't work for me. But, you know, Jerry's in real bad shape. I'm going to take him." So I said, "Oh, good. Then we're not going to have to quit drinking, huh?" "No, we're not quitting," he said. So I said, "Oh, okay." So about 9:15, he comes in the house, and he looked at me strangely, and he said, "I've just had deja vu." I said, "What?" He said, "You know, at that meeting, I knew everything that every person was going to say before they said it." He said, it would go around in my head, you know, like, "Oh, well, we're powerless over alcohol." He said, "I'd say, right before this other came out of his mouth, I'm powerless over alcohol." He said, "I said it before they said it." And I looked at him, and I knew that there was some change in his eyes. I could tell that there had been something going on at that meeting that had changed him. I didn't know what it was, but he was changed. And he actually has never had a drink since that night. But I just kept drinking, you know. And I'd sit there in the chair. He'd go to the meetings, and I'd sit there in my chair, my poor me chair. Poor, pitiful me, you know, married to an alcoholic, and he's made me an alcoholic. And what in the heck am I going to do with my life? So one day he came in, and we had the privilege of meeting Jim W., and a lot of you may know him, through Betty and Charles. And Mike came into the house one night, come in from a meeting. He said, "You know, over at this group, they have something they call a a step study night, and they have speakers come over and do the steps for the whole month. And he said, and Jim W.'s doing the steps this month over at Mid-Cities. Would you like to come hear him? I said, you know, I think I would. I'd heard some of his tapes. I thought, he's really funny, and I think I'll go hear him. So that's how I got to AA. Jim was just amazing, and I listened to him for four nights, and I thought, well, you know, this maybe this is can help me. You know, I didn't know if it could, but maybe it will. Maybe it'll help me. But I'm not going to have to join AA, you know, or do those awful things on that list over there, like telling somebody stuff about yourself. I was just wouldn't do that. I'd just cross that off. Fifth step, nope, not doing that. So I joined AA. And fortunately for me, I got a sponsor that wouldn't put up with my nonsense. So I was there, and I told her one day, I said, you're trying to brainwash me. And she said, your brain needs washing. What do you say to that? I said, these people are crazy. Then I came in one day with AA's just a crutch. She said, if you're a cripple, you need a crutch. You are crippled. You are an emotional cripple, and you refuse a crutch? I thought, God. Maybe she's right. She was always right. Yeah, always right. She always had the perfect comeback for me. She later told me, years later, she said, I didn't know if I was going to make it with you. She said, you were the toughest nut to crack that I have ever sponsored. And I said, oh, good. I'm special. Oh, man. Then she told me my thinking was wrong. You know, she said, you don't think right. I said, how can I not think right? I've graduated from college with a 4.0 average, GPA. What do you mean my thinking's wrong? I'm smart. She said, you may be too smart to get sober. And she said, I want you to read the big book. I said, I tried that. It's just too simplistic. And she said, you know, you may be right. Your brain may have too much alcohol in it still. You better wait a while. You may not be able to understand it. And then in my mind, I called her that B word, you know. I said, I'll show her. So I went and got a big book and opened it up and read it, you know, right straight through. And I told her that. And she said, well, why'd you get out of it? And I said, really nothing. And she said, well, you're going to have to study it. And we're going to have to start working the steps. So we worked the steps. And I got to do all those good things like Cody talked about last night. You know, and I did the third step prayer on my knees with my sponsor. And she says, we do this so you won't forget. You can never say that you've not taken the third step, because this is the third step you're taking right now. And so then she showed a little line at the bottom of that page that said, once this decision is made, meaning the decision to accept step three and do the prayer, then we at once start out on a house cleaning. And so she said, at once, I want you to leave this meeting. I want you to go to the wherever and buy a notebook and a pen and put it up on top of your dresser, someplace you can see it every day, so it'll remind you that you need to write your fourth step. And I said, well, I've got plenty of notebooks and pens at home. She said, those are not going to do. You got to have one for your inventory. That's you've gone and bought specially for that. And so I said, well, she's been awfully picky. You know, that's just whatever. But I was learning and being taught how to follow directions, you know, and I was not liking it too much. Because she just wouldn't put up with me. She just wouldn't do it. And I was so afraid that she was going to fire me. I told her, you're not going to fire me, are you? And she said, no, I'm not going to fire you. But you may wish that I'd fire you. So, anyway, I didn't work on my fourth step. I put it off and put it off, and I kept seeing that pen and notebook there, and I just would pass it by and move my eyes anywhere but there. So one day I went down to a meeting, and I happened, for some reason, I don't know why, I carried that notebook and pen with me to the noon meeting. And about 5 minutes before the meeting started, my sponsor walked in. And she said, what are you holding there? And I said, well, I brought this thing. I don't even know why I brought it. She said, you go in that room right over there and write your fourth step. And I want it done by the time this meeting is over. And I thought, well, golly, I have so many resentments. How am I going to do that in an hour? That's impossible. And that's one reason that I never would start the inventory. I just thought it would be so long and so complicated and so difficult to do that I'd just be working on it, you know, till I was 50 years old. I finished that inventory within an hour. And it probably was the best inventory I ever did. Because what I found out was that all of those resentments boil down to one big one, you know. My childhood, my husband, and that was about it. That was about the only people that I was really resenting and had resented, and they'd ruined my life. So we went to her house that night, and she said, you finish your fourth step. And I made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself within an hour. And that afternoon, we went to her house, and I was at her house till after midnight. And we found a lot more things than a whole lot more things. So, it also says in the big book that you need to tell someone your whole life story. It's written there, black and white. That's what she would tell me, read the black part of the book. So I got really into the steps after I realized the relief and the freedom that I got from that inventory. I walked away from it, like it says, with a new outlook on life and a new way to handle things. So it was the first step. It says that this is the first step to show that you're willing to go on to the next steps. So, we're entirely ready to have God remove all my defects of character. I was certainly ready for that. I didn't realize how many I had, but I knew I had a lot of defects. Now, Mike didn't. We were driving home one night, and he said, you know, they talk about defects of character. He said, they're talking about these defects of character. You know what they're talking about? I said, no. He said, I don't think I have any. And I said, and I said, you don't. Now that you've quit drinking, you're fine. That was like maybe the third month he had been sober. So anyway, when I got there, I was suicidal. I was homicidal. I had tried to kill my beloved husband with what are those things called? Skewers. Those metal skewers. Yeah. I was gonna making what are those? Shish kebab, right. Now, I was quite a bit smaller than I am now. And I started running across the room with this shish kebab in my hand. And he caught my arm just right before it went in. I mean, he foiled me again, you know. So, anyway, he wrapped that skewer around my fist. I mean, I wouldn't let go of it because I was afraid if I let go of it, it'd be used. I'd be the shish kebab. So it was wrapped totally. He just took it and wrapped it. He was so mad, you know. Just, you were trying to kill me, and he just wrapped that around. I couldn't get it off of my hand because it just wrapped around. Oh, this is so much fun. Oh, goodness. I did eventually get to that step there where I was wanting God to remove my, you know, when you find your character defects, for me anyway, I couldn't get, they were right here. You know, if I turned this way, it was right here in front of me. If I turned this way, they were right here. I couldn't get away from them. Once you know something, you can never unknow it. Once you know something about yourself, you can never unknow it or make it different. You just can't do it. You know it. You own it, I think Charleston calls it. And that's what I just know. You know what it is, and what are you willing to do now? Where are you going next? You've got these defects, and you can't get rid of them yourself. What are you going to do? You just have to become willing. You know, I had to become willing to give them up. So we went through that, and we came to the humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Now, the big book and the 12 and 12, too, has some really good stuff in there about humility, and I encourage you to read that. I know when after I finished my fifth step, my sponsor told me to go and read in the big book where it says, you're now going to go on to the next one. You look and see if your house is built with mortar, if your foundation is good, and that you have something to build on. And if you can answer yes to this question, then you're ready to ask God to remove these from you. You've become humble enough to ask. So that's what I wanted to talk about was when I finally, it was probably after this step, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, that I began to want to give up this victim role that I had placed myself in. And that was what I did, was when I realized that it was myself who had made myself the victim. There was no one that was making me a victim now. You know, when I was 4 years old, 5 years old, 6 years old, I was a victim, and I made that decision based on self. It kept me from being hurt, okay? But now, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 38 years old, and I'm still thinking like a 5-year-old. So I made a conscious decision that I was not going to be a victim any longer. I was going to walk in the sunlight of the Spirit. So that's what I did. That decision that I made, and it's been my anchor ever since. I had a good deal of difficulty with the God concept, and in this part of the steps, the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th, is when I really began to seek God to be in my life. And there was a lot of things that we had a spot, Mike and I had sponsors, and people were telling us to pray together. You need to pray together. Well, Mike and I were just kind of not really speaking to each other too much. He went to one meeting and I went to another one. And we, like specters crossing in the night. So we were in our bed and he said, they tell us that we need to pray. And he did or I did. I don't know which one of us said it. But anyway, we agreed that we needed to pray. And so he stuck his hand out like this. He was on one side of the bed and I was way on the other side. And we just reached the tips of each other's fingers. And Mike said a little prayer. He said, God, come into our life and make us what you will. And that was, nothing happened. But the next day, I was going out of the group and he was coming in the group and our eyes met. And that's probably been the first time in 10 years that we had actually looked each other in the eye. And he said he knew at that moment that everything was going to be all right with us. And I knew the same thing because I had that same feeling. When I looked him in the eye, everything's going to be all right. One day, a bunch of friends and I were sitting down at the club, and Mike walked in, and they asked me, have you met the new guy? And I said, yeah, that's my husband. They said, that's Mike? I said, yes, that's Mike. I want to talk to y'all a little bit about the last 3 years and the trials and tribulations that we've gone through and had God walk through with us. And, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been around long enough to watch and be privileged to watch a lot of people die. And I found that the ones that I've known and watched seem to die with a peace and a dignity that I hope I will be able to do when my time comes. 3 years ago, we didn't have a job. And I decided, well, maybe I better go back to nursing. So I went and I had 7 interviews. And I had never in my life gone to an interview for a nurse and been turned down. They'd usually hire me, but can you start right now? So I had 7 interviews and nobody wanted me. I just couldn't understand it. So I was waiting one night for my last call from my last interview to find out if I was going to get that job. And a man called me and said, no, he wasn't going to, he decided they were going to use somebody else. And so I was so upset because this just never happened to me before. And so I raised my hand up to God like this and I said, God, if you want me to have a job, you're going to have to call me on the telephone. About 3 or 4 weeks prior to this, my sponsor's husband called me, her husband called her and said, "Is Joellen still looking for a job?" And she said, "Well, yeah, she is. I don't think anybody's hired her." And he said, "Well, it was tax season," and he works down at H&R Block during the rush years. He said, "You think she'd come down here and, you know, work as a secretary and help us get these things done?" And she said, "Well, I don't know. I'll ask her." So she asked me, and I said, "I'll do anything." So that was where I was working when the last call came in that nobody wanted me. You know, that's hard to go to 7 interviews and be turned down. And them begging for nurses, I just couldn't understand why I wouldn't get this job. Any jobs. And so I was there at the H&R Block when I asked God to call me on the telephone. And that night, that afternoon, I was sitting at the front, out at the front desk, and my cell phone rang. So I got my phone out, and it's my brother. He said, "Joellen, this is David." I said, "Yeah." He said, I "Can't talk. I'm at work." And he said, "Well, just a minute." I said, "I can't talk. I'm at work." He said, "Just a minute. I want you to come to work for me." And I thought, God just called me out the door. And now Mike and I are having our 4th year working for my brother. And so our financial situation is very stable right now, and we're really happy about that. And everything's going well financially for us. But in February of 2009, I lost my mom. And she'd been sick for a long, long time. And I would go and see her periodically. And what I was doing when I was realized that in the past what I had been doing when I went to see my parents was I was going to for them to see me. You know, I've got to go down there so they can see me. And I was missing the whole point. And it came to me one day that my attitude should be, I'm going to there to see them. I wanted to, I was working at that point, my sponsor had asked me to work on being the best daughter that I could be. And when I started doing that, that's when I found that I owed them the respect and that I went to see them, not them seeing me. You know, that's ego right there, you know, when you want them to see you. But in 2009, my mom passed away, and I was fortunate enough to be there with her when that happened. I was standing at the side of her bed, and she died very peacefully. We buried her on a Friday, Saturday, I think. And then on Monday, we left going home. And my mom was a beautiful singer. She had just a gorgeous voice. And when we were small, my brother and sister and I would ask her to sing for us. You know, she'd sing the old 40 songs, the boogie woogies and all that, play the piano and sing a boogie woogie. And there was this one song that was my favorite, which was "I'll Be Seeing You." And I'd always wanted to sing "I'll Be Seeing You." And if she would wait to the very end, she's out, "Just hold on, Joellen, hold on." So at the very end, she said, "Okay, now I'm going to sing Joellen's song, and then there will be no more singing." So she would sing "I'll Be Seeing You," and then we'd go on about our business, and she'd go back to doing what she was doing at home. So when we came home on Sunday night from the funeral, it was Academy Awards night, and Queen Latifah walked out on the stage, And all the, they were streaming across this, you know, all the people that had died that last year, the famous people. And the song that she was singing was, "I'll Be Seeing You." And I had not been able to cry at my mother's funeral. And I sat in my living room and cried that night because I knew that my mom was okay. She was okay. On January the 4th of this year, 2010, I lost my sponsor of 12 years. She had leukemia, and she was diagnosed with leukemia when she was 70 years old. And the only treatment for leukemia is a bone marrow transplant, and you're not eligible for a bone marrow transplant unless you are 70 or under 70. If you're 70, you don't qualify. And she had turned 70 like 3 days before she found out. So she was sick. They told her she would live a year, and she lived a little over 2 years. And that was purely from her strength of character. You know, she was at the Thursday night women's meeting every Thursday night. She didn't miss it. And she continued to go to meetings up until her last hospital stay. And I got to watch her die as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to walk through that with her. 1 week before she died, she and I had decided to go out to eat lunch, and we chose Le Madeleine's. So I went by and picked her up because she couldn't drive anymore. And we went to Le Madeleine's, and I, passed down there and got my tray, and I ran over and put it on the table, and then I ran over to her, and I said, "Mary Lou, I'll carry your tray." And she looked at me, and she said, "I can carry my own tray, thank you." So she carried her own tray. About 2 weeks later, we got home from wherever we were working. And I had a phone call that she was in the hospital. So I rushed down to the emergency room, and she was very, very sick. Her fever was 105, and they thought she was probably going to die there in the emergency room. But they gave her some antibiotics, and she got better, and they put her in the hospital. And we left again for a week. We had to go on another little business trip. And when I came back, there was a message on my phone from Ron, her husband, who said, "You need to come to the hospital if you want to see Mary Lou alive." So I jumped up and ran down to the hospital real quick and went to her room, and there was a bunch of people there, you know, a bunch of people that she sponsored. Her grandchildren were there. Her son was there. Her husband was there. Some old friends, AA friends were there. There were about 10 of us in her room. But she had been unconscious for 26 hours. And they thought she was, would pass away without regaining consciousness. But about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, her eyes came open. And she looked all around and said, "Oh my goodness, all the people in the world that I love are right here around me." And she said, "I just want to tell y'all that God's power is not limited. God's love is not limited." And we were just hanging on every word she was saying because, you know, she'd been pretty close. Because she said, "You know, I was walking down this hallway, and there was a big light at the end of the hallway." And then she said, she thought a minute, and she said, no, it wasn't a hallway. It was a tunnel, I believe. And there was a light at the end of the tunnel. And she said, I got there, and the door wouldn't open, and I woke up. And then she'd say, well, y'all talk to me. And we were all speechless. I mean, all 10 of us were just standing there, you know, waiting for some more of her wisdom to come out. That you know, it was like God had just planned that. Had everybody there that she loved. And she told us, you know, that God loved us unconditionally. And his love was not limited. So she said she needed to take a little, go to the bathroom. And so she asked everybody to go out of the room except Joellen. Joellen stayed with me because, you know, I'm a nurse and she knows I was a nurse, so I was going to help her get up on the potty. And I did, and we called the nurse's aide in, and she came and helped. And when she got there, she stood up. And I was just gonna, you know, twirl her around and send her right back on the bed. And when she stood up and I twirled her around, she sat on the side of the bed. She fell over dead, actually in my arms. She died in my arms. And I guess that's the most wonderful thing that's ever happened to me, to have a sponsor like her. She taught me how to be a lady. I didn't know how to be a lady, but she taught me how. And she taught me how to stay sober and how to live sober and to be happy, joyous, and free. And I think of her every day. And I love her every day. So I want to thank you all for listening to my story. And I hope that... we'll see you again someday here. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.